Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shops, the Spectator's political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm joined by Jane Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. So James, over the weekend we heard about May and Corbyn, who are set to hold further talks, and we've this morning heard about this warm letter that May has written to Corbyn. Are we about to see a kind of deal between the two of them?
So I think the tone of this letter, as you say, is surprisingly warm. I mean, it isn't just a pure point-scoring letter. But it is worth noting that she isn't moving on the kind of permanent customs union, which Corbyn wants as a kind of proof that he has forced, you know, because he knows the damage it does to the Tory party if Theresa May accepts it. But I think what you see Theresa May trying to do is she's now actually emphasising the bits in her deal that do look rather like a customs union. And you also see her unveiling kind of individual concession after concession, designed, I think, to try and peel off individual Labour MPs to back the deal. So, for example, we're not going to get full-on dynamic alignment with the EU on workers' rights and environmental rights, but she will legislate so that every time the EU changes the rules on these areas, Parliament gets a vote on whether it wants to follow suit. In a way, this isn't that much of a concession, because if there's a majority in Parliament for following suit, that suggests that the governing party wants to follow suit. And so it's not that much of a concession. But it's all mood music, I think, designed to make it easier for 30 or so Labour MPs to vote for her deal.
Fraser, what do you make of May cozying up to Corbyn?
Well, I'm not sure what to make of it, really. I mean, Parliament has given her a clear mandate that she goes to Brussels and she negotiates a little addendum to her deal, not very much to ask, a standard break clause. In other words, either party can terminate with, say, 6 months' notice. Now, this is part of every deal struck by every free country pretty much in the world. So it ought to be an easy ask. But I've noticed, since Parliament has given her this mandate, she hasn't expressed it in these clear terms. She's been very vague about what she wants, which is odd, given that if she were to say, clearly, all I want is a break clause, that's not much to ask, she'd probably get momentum behind her. Which makes me wonder, does she actually want to do what Parliament has told her to do? Or would she prefer to say, well, I tried, I failed, they wouldn't budge, so now it's either my deal or it's no deal. In other words, whether she is so pig-headed that her real agenda isn't to try to get the MPs to repent of their mass rebellion against her and back her after all. Now, her cozying up to Corbyn is consistent with that. What one of the many strategies she's tried is to say to her Tory backbenchers, look, if you guys don't back my deal, then I might get into bed with Jeremy Corbyn and you wouldn't like that, would you? And I've heard one Tory cabinet member say he finds that quite persuasive. I want to not move to the left at all, and if we don't back her deal now, she's going to keep moving to the left, so we need to keep this nice and conservative and back her. Now, I'm beginning to wonder if she is going to go through this little, at this very last minute, if she actually isn't going to try very hard to get the deal which I believe to be in sight. Now, I am no fan of her deal. I don't know many people who do think it's a good thing. In fact, I can think of no more than five or six MPs who would actually say that her deal is objectively good as opposed to the least bad option. But I think I would certainly back it. A lot of Tory MPs would back it if they thought it was a bridge to something else. In other words, you would make that compromise if you thought something better might be at the end of it. But without that break clause, there is no guarantee at all it will be a bridge to something else. Now, is she willing to go along with this mandate, or is she not? And I'm beginning to wonder if she, in fact, she isn't.
I think that she knows she needs something on the backstop to try and get this past Parliament and her own party.
But why is she being so vague, James? I can't work this. Why doesn't she say, give an example of what she needs? Because we all know that it's not very much. It's not very unreasonable.
I think in reality, she, number 10, don't think they're going to get what one might call the full malt house. But I think they might.
The malt house compromise.
Yeah. But so I mean, they think they have.
What's the malt house compromise?
The malt house compromise is essentially to use technology to deal with the problem rather than the backstop as currently in the withdrawal agreement. So I think instead she will try and push for either a time limit or some kind of clearer exit mechanism. So but I think she knows even if she gets that, she reasons that there is probably somewhere between 20 and 30 ERG MPs who wouldn't vote for it even with those changes. So what you see going on here is the attempt to basically create a mood music. That means that it's safe for enough Labour MPs to back the deal to get it over the line. I don't think she's going to strike some grand bargain with Corbyn, but what she's trying to do is to create, it's this kind of Rees-Mogg McCluskey strategy. She's trying to create enough cover for Labour MPs to back her deal without it looking like a straightforward betrayal. She wants to be able to sit for these MPs to have enough stuff to point to so they can say that they've got something out of it.
But James, don't you think she then faces the same problem that she faced when she was defeated so heavily last time? That, yes, she can make eyes at Labour, she can talk about workers' rights, she can talk about bugging a couple of million quid to a constituency here or there, but there are only about a dozen, perhaps 20 max, Labour MPs who she's ever going to peel off in that way.
I think if you look at the votes on last time the Cooper Amendment came back and all that, that suggests that there, I think, are a pool of 30 or so Labour MPs.
What, willing to vote with the Tories?
To either abstain or vote with the Tories on this. I also think the other question is this, is it might be that they would be technically defying the leadership. But you know, the Labour MPs who didn't vote for the Cooper Amendment technically defied the leadership, but no one thinks that they've been called in and kind of carpeted on the floor of the Whip's office, you know. Instead, it's been a kind of, oh, we understand why you got to that position. And that is the question here, which is, you know, we all know that Corbyn wants Brexit to be over with and done because it is such a threat to his own coalition, but he somehow wants it to happen without his fingerprints being on it. And that, I think, is a very, very tricky to have that happen because of the parliamentary arithmetic. And therefore, I think kind of him, some blind eye turning from the Labour Party to a bunch of MPs abstaining or voting with the government to get the deal through is not unlikely.
After her last defeat, she said that she would be doing Brexit talks differently. She'd be taking Geoffrey Cox with her. She'd be taking Steve Barclay, the Brexit secretary. Now, we do have a meeting, a dinner. This is so weird the way the EU does this. A dinner, not a meeting, between Steve Barclay and Barnier this evening in Brussels. But I have to say, I don't see that much of a change in the way that she's negotiating. It's still Ollie Robbins in charge of it. Ollie Robbins, the architect of the backstop. Of course, he's going to want to defend the device that he created. So I am really beginning to wonder if she is taking the olive branch the Parliament offered her. And for a while, I actually was quite optimistic, thinking that there is going to be a common sense agreement between Parliament and the EU over this, as long as political egos didn't get in the way. Now, I think the obstacle is only partly the EU's intransigence, a major problem, but I think Theresa May's ego, something which I think is quite underrated in the Brexit equation, might also be beginning to become an obstacle, and it might make no deal more likely.
And James, what do you make of these reports that emerged over the weekend of this new centrist party, which J.K. Rowling is reportedly involved in?
So the meeting took place at the literary agency that represents J.K. Rowling, the name the Blair Partnership, rather confusingly, because that has nothing to do with Tony Blair, rather it's named after a literary agent. Now, tempting as it is to do kind of Harry Potter and the new party of the centre and all this stuff, I do think something has changed, which is that we've heard for almost ever since Corbyn became Labour leader, we've heard a kind of, oh, maybe we'll split off, maybe we'll split off. Those are moving from kind of whispers and murmurs. They're becoming increasingly vocal. I mean, there are two issues driving it. One is anti-Semitism and the kind of leadership's kind of not doing enough in the views of these MPs to deal with that. And on the other hand, there is the question of Brexit, when it is becoming kind of clearer and clearer that Jeremy Corbyn is, you know, it's not like Jeremy Corbyn lies awake at night dreaming of a second referendum. It's quite clear that he just wants this done in some way, shape or form. So I think after Brexit, a Labour split is almost certain. I mean, the big question is, how do you get numbers en masse, you know? So if you get, you know, Chris Leslie and Owen Smith and people like that going off, that is not the beginnings of a mass movement. And I think this is where the fact that the meeting took place at a literary agency is particularly interesting, because the obvious way to give it mass is to come with people who come with a ready-made following. And, you know, J.K. Rowling is a pretty obvious example of that, somewhere with 14.5 million Twitter followers. When the SDP split away, the Gang of Four, those were huge figures in British politics. None of the people, you know, whether it's Chuck Ramuna or Chris Leslie or whatever, are anywhere near the same level of national prestige as Roy Jenkins was when he joined the SDP, or David Owen was when he joined the SDP, you know, former foreign secretary and all that. So the question is, where do they get the star power from, and where do they get the kind of, where do they get the wow factor? And I think that is the intriguing question about what's going on at the moment.
Fraser, do you think J.K. Rowling's got the magic that the centrist party might need?
I don't see why, if a reality TV star like Donald Trump can't become president of America, why J.K. Rowling can't sprinkle some Harry Potter magic stardust on the British political movement. I mean, let's face it, the centrists have tried everything else. They've tried splits, they've tried announcing a new party on Twitter, they've tried even the Liberal Democrats, and nothing seems to work. So I think it's time that something extra special came along to break the logjam, I think, J.K. Rowling. Well, let's face it, it couldn't be much worse than what the centrists have tried so far.
Thank you, Fraser and James. And just a reminder that we've got a new special offer this week. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12, as well as a free £10 Amazon voucher. To get this, just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.